Good evening. Thank you. Thank you for coming. That's an interesting way to start. Yeah, all things dad. How do you quantify that? And I think a lot of what I'm going to talk about tonight involves how I make a living, basically, researching the power of fatherhood, and trying to flip the script a bit and try to cast my fatherhood and masculinity in a better light, because I have two boys of my own, and I want them to inherit a more enlightened idea of what passes for masculinity currently. I think there's a lot of association with fatherhood, especially that goes unnoticed. And I think that when you see the kind of news that you see about how dads work, I mean, I have a Google search set up for fathers and dads, and when I look at all the articles, about 70% of them are pretty bad. You know, they involve all sorts of terrible things, and so we're not just an unproven market; we're a disproven market. But at the same time, there's a lot going on, and if you see, a lot of that has to do with how dads are portrayed in the media. A lot of that has to do with how dads are considered in legislation. A lot of that has to do with the way dads are viewed in the courts. And so we're just trying to elevate the voices of regular dads who just love what they do. And many of them write about it and get involved in social media. And that's where the Dad 2.0 Summit comes in. This is the conference that my partner and I founded back in 2011. And it's basically a... That's how we describe it, an annual conference where marketers, social media leaders, and blogging parents connect to discuss the changing voice and perception of modern fatherhood. It's funny, because as I put this speech together, this is the exact speech I gave to my landlords, you know, when I first moved to Ann Arbor. They wanted to know what I did for a living and how, you know, and to figure out if I was a viable tenant, you know, if I could actually make a living at this. And this is what I basically spent the time talking to them about. That and to my parents. I've told my parents this 6 times. And they're getting it. They're getting close to it. I'm also shaking the plague that's been invading all of us lately. So I'll try to keep coughing to a minimum. So as far as the Dad 2 Summit goes, Dad 2.0 was invented in 2011. So to start off, I usually begin a little history about me. Does anyone know what a dad blogger is? Does anyone read dad blogs or mom blogs or blogs at all? Okay. Well, I began blogging about my fatherhood when my son was 15 months old. I was working in New York, on Wall Street, actually, and as an editor for Iniquity Research Weekly, and I got laid off. And so here I was, home with my child, who was 15 months old, my son, and I was laid off, and I was a dad, and I called my blog Laid Off Dad, because I had a lot of creativity back then, not like now. But again, it wasn't even something that people considered in terms of when you name a blog. I mean, so much when you write a blog, if you choose to go into this and try to make it a viable business, which is what a lot of our dads do now, they come to the Dad 2.0 Summit and they reach out to brands and they look at blogs now as an arm of social media marketing and content marketing and working with brands that way to help relate to their consumers specifically. And there are lots of dads now who make a living at this. And so because you do that, how you frame yourself, how you decide who you are, what type of dad you are, what your name is, that matters a lot now, you know, because once you choose something, you're stuck with it. And you have to go and have it match your Twitter feed and your Google Plus ID and your Instagram feed. And everything else has to match up, and your Pinterest board and all sorts of social media aspects that we pursue as part of this viable financial strategy to actually be a paid blogger. So but when I chose Laid Off Dad, I just kind of, you know, there was no business, there was no nothing. There were, and I was basically writing about what it was like to be a dad on the playground, because there weren't, you know, back then there really weren't a lot of men on the playground during the week. There are many more now, which is great to hear. And, but back in the day, back in 2003, 2004, I was living off a severance package, so I had some leeway until I got my second job, the next job. But at the time, I just noticed that I was just on the playground. It was me and a bunch of moms and a bunch of nannies. And I didn't even have a phone to stare at. You know, we didn't have smartphones back in 2003. So I bought the newspaper, or most of the time I played with my kids. I played hide and seek. And, I would play hide and seek, and I'd hide, and he'd forget to look for me, and I'd fall asleep on the bench. And luckily, it was a great neighborhood, a great secure playground in the city that had, we had lots of parents who knew each other and knew me and kind of embraced me. They made the best of what they could make of it, you know, as a dad among moms. And that was something that was one of the initial issues that confronted dads a lot, the whole idea of how do you relate to a bunch of female caregivers, and at the same time, why is it that that caregivers are all female, and if a man is caregiving, he's babysitting? Yeah, there you go. Really, you're a stay-at-home dad?
No, I teach early childhood.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Even better. So then what we say later about childhood development and fatherhood is hopefully will resonate even better with you. Because that's how I spend my day. That's how I love to spend my day, is just reading everything about Pew Research and working with the School of Social Work here at U of M. They had this great symposium, this series of lectures this year, open to the public once a week. They had fatherhood researchers from all over the country come in and talk about how fathers support children on a economic level, on a social level, just the impact both of having a father there and having a father gone. And we'll talk about that a lot as well. It's actually quite jarring what kind of impact you can have. And it's great that this kind of discussion is being amplified, because we've been doing this now for 4 years, and now you see something like Esquire magazine has a whole issue. The June issue was about fatherhood, and it was remarkable. And we're going to get to that in a minute, because one of my favorite writers who wrote the Fatherhood Manifesto, I'll be talking from that liberally later on, and he's coming to speak at the conference later in February, so I'm very excited to meet him and have him knock our socks off, because he's very erudite and very passionate, and anytime you can harness that kind of energy behind our effort, it's a great thing. So, as far as I was blogging, I was a parent blogger, and it was me and a bunch of moms mostly. There are a handful of dads, but not many. I started going to blogging conferences in 2005, and one of the biggest, most famous is a conference called Blog Her, which is about empowering women in media. But again, that's where all of my colleagues and peers at the time were going, because they were all women. And I went because, screw it, I'm going. These are my friends I want to meet. I mean, these are my online friends. It's very weird to meet someone for the first time when you've been reading about them for years. And you finally put a face to a personality that you feel you know very well, and yet you've never actually shook hands or hugged them. So that was what 2005 was about. And then 2008 came along, and I stand before you as the first male speaker at the Blogger Conference, which... you know, it's not Sandra Day O'Connor, but it's a big deal. You know, I like it. I'm very proud of that, I think, because that shows how, when you work in this business as a male parent blogger and you're in the minority, the steep minority, it gives you a good perspective, because white males like myself are in the majority everywhere else. And that's a terribly skewed perspective to have. And I think it's every person, one way or another, should see what it's like to be outnumbered and recognize how it is to work in that environment. And it gives you empathy for situations when you're in the majority, which for me is most of the time. as you might imagine, you know, given all the news of the past couple weeks, I've filtered lots of discussions among the dads in my Facebook group about what it means to be a dad in our culture and what it means to have white male privilege and how we cope with that and how we search to have our, you know, we want to express our opinions, but we want to express them in a way that is useful, you know, that I doesn't just, because sometimes you get into those situations and you just can't win. And again, this is something, these are discussions we're having now. We're talking about what it means to be a father and to raise children in a society that we're building together. And I think the whole point of being a stay-at-home dad or an active father in a kid's life is it's a difference between a rudderless adolescent or an adolescent who knows where he's going and can make a real difference in the world. So anyway, then in 2011, we grew out of the conferences. There was a Mom 2.0 summit, which started in 2009. So during their third conference, we were given a dad track. We were given a room that was just dad-based material. And it was standing room only. It was really remarkably well received. I was really very happy to see that. And so we announced at Mom 2.0 that we were going to be Dad 2.0. And all we had was that logo I showed you and an idea. We didn't have a venue. We didn't have a date. But we did have an idea, and we had a plan. And we also had a disproven market, but with proven people, because the same people were doing the same thing. I mean, we work with them, and they have a successful brand and a successful business, and so we knew we could work with them. So, now, when you talk about the first three conferences we've had, our fourth one is coming up in February, in about 9 weeks, but who's counting? 2012, 2013, 2014, each had a particular story. Now, the most famous one, I guess, is when I talk about Huggies. I mean, the Dad 2.0 Summit is billed as a conference and a discussion between brands and dad bloggers. So, right about the time when our first conference was starting, there was an ad from Huggies that basically said, we put our Huggies to the ultimate challenge, dads. And it was basically moms were going away for the week, and dads were in charge of diapering their kids for a week. And it was just, you know, the babies are miserable in the high chairs, clearly need to be changing, and the dad's playing a ukulele, and he's, you know, he's helpless. And like many ad campaigns, there was a social media arm attached to it. And so on the Facebook page, there was a lot of blowback. There was a lot of men saying, I know how to diaper my kid. Why would you portray me that way? And the women were like, my husband knows how to diaper a kid. Why would you portray him that way? I married him. I don't call my husband a dope. And that was kind of the zeitgeist about 3-4 years ago, was the whole idea you would relate to moms by insulting, you know, rolling your eyes at the dad. You know, and that's what, like, see what I mean, ladies? Am I right? You know, and that was kind of the way to try to attract yourself and ingratiate yourself with moms by teaching us all to roll our eyes at our incompetent fathers in the mix, which unfortunately is many women's experience, and we're trying to change that, you know, and we're going to get to that too, because this year so much of what we're talking about is about mentorship, about hands-on effort to really turn the tide and recognize that there's ways, you know, like Esquire says, how do you build a man? You know, let's build a man. Let's get him educated. Let's incorporate him in the conversation about how we're raising our children. So many other brands had suffered through something similar. They had put up an ad that was kind of insulting to dads, and then the blowback came and they would hide. They'd just say, like, let's just duck for cover, wait till it's over, and then move on. But Huggies made a difference. Huggies said, we want to confront this. We want to know where we screwed up. And so I got a call the Thursday before our first conference. I got a call from the head of the PR department of the firm that handled Huggies and said, would it be okay if I sent three brand managers from Kimberly-Clark down to Austin To talk to dads one-on-one about how they could improve their relations with dads and how they could make amends for this ad campaign. And so I'm on the phone. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, we can do that. You know, I mean, it was amazing because, of course, how else are you going to have brand managers from a major network, a major company, come talk to you at your first conference? I mean, you want to have a conversation with brands, and these were decision makers who were coming to talk specifically to us. And they came down, they flew to Austin the day of, and we were dovetailing with the South by Southwest in Austin that weekend. So getting into Austin was not easy. Paying for tickets was not easy. Resources were stretched to the limit, and they made it here. And they spent a lot of time and money and energy to be in Austin with us. And they took our suggestions and they recut their footage and relaunched their campaign entirely, and it was a huge hit. And that is I know this is like 3 years old now, but Huggies and I have spoken about this a number of places, including at BlogHer, to talk about the success of an ad campaign and the success of confronting whatever social media blowback you have, recognizing, doing a mea culpa, and coming back. And recognizing that if you did screw up, it's not irrevocable. You know, you can make lemonade out of lemons, and they did. And so I bring up Huggies now. I know they don't like me to bring it up because it's a three-year-old story, but it's a monumental thing for us. It was a tectonic shift. It could not have been more happily timed in terms of when it happened, just right when we started. And that gave us a big boost because we appeared in some, you know, the word that they were going down there put us in Advertising Age and Ad Week, and The Washington Post picked it up, and people were interested. So that was the story from 2012. Then in 2013, I say Anise, because that's, you may know, the mayor of Houston is Anise Parker, who is the only openly gay major city mayor in the country. And she is obviously a big fan of non-traditional families, recognizing that a parent is a parent, and recognizing that we want to just, anybody who wants to involve themselves in the life of a kid to help bring him up into this world and raise him properly, that nothing else matters. And she came to our conference with an entourage, made a great entrance, and opened our conference in Houston and really gave us her blessing in a way. She had just been on the Colbert Report and then she came and spoke with us, and that was that made a big dent in our TV coverage, because the TV coverage in Houston came to cover that. And again, just it's amazing how the power of embarking on something, you know, just ask, just try. We said, well, what if we can get the mayor to show up? And she did. And that was huge. So, and then 2014 we were in New Orleans, and you may recall we had this huge ice storm that froze Atlanta. You know, there were 2 inches of snow on the ground, and Atlanta highways froze, and I-10 between I-10 west of New Orleans was frozen and shut down for like 36 hours. And it was still like 15 degrees below normal temperatures there the entire time we were there. And they don't have insulation. They don't know anything. So their windows are, there's no grout. What's insulation? They don't know from cold. So, It's less newsworthy, but it's also fun in that we always have something to point to that we always recognize. And so I say this is a story that we talk about, because since we emerged from Mom 2.0, we came from Eve's rib. And it usually gets a laugh. Because it's true. You know, we came from them. We love the moms. We know that we can't get where we are. We can't do anything. You know, we're standing on the shoulders of women who've blazed a very important trail, if I can destroy a couple of mixed metaphors, and recognize that another conference tried to do this without the help of moms, to kind of shut moms out entirely, and it fell flat on its face because we needed their help. So I looked around for a long time to find the right graphic. There's usually lots of Renaissance paintings, but I figured that was something that was generic enough. So, I want to say thank you to all the media and all of the sponsors who have who have helped us over the past 3 years. And I wanted to mention them here because these are people who understand, especially the sponsors down below, they're the ones who support us, who support me, who really want to work with dads and kind of, we kind of know that the message doesn't get out unless you put some money behind it and you use the airwaves and you actually create some really interesting content that is going to be seen by a lot of people. And we don't have that power yet. We're looking for that. And so, but you look at somebody like Dove Men Plus Care, we'll get to them in a second. They've been our title sponsor 3 years in a row. Lee Jeans, Honda was our vehicle sponsor 2 years in a row. Lego's been there 3 years. Again, I'm really thankful to all those people, and I'm thankful to the media who have supported us and written about us. And we had a great piece in the New York Times as well about our conference, and it was really great. So now, again, I'm talking about the conference a lot at this point, but trust me, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty about fatherhood in a moment. I want to shout out just Dove Men Plus Care. They sponsored our first event. They were a regular sponsor in 2012. They've been our title sponsor 3 years in a row. They've done some great ad campaigns with famous athletes talking about fatherhood. They did one with the big league dads, talked about what it was like to be away from their kids 6 months a year. The Journey to Comfort, there were a lot of dads involved with that. Kirk Herbstreit, John Elway, Doug Flutie, Jay Billis, Dwayne Wade. They're very heavily involved in mentorship campaigns. And we are going to work with them a lot on that, in terms of trying to set up a grassroots campaign to make people more aware of this. And we're happy that Dove is working on this and Esquire magazine is working on this, and we want to bring all those together and try and build a bonfire of effort to get more men. And it's not just boys. I mean, we can talk about how many men are in prison right now and how many men are separated from their children. That's never too early to get back into your kid's life. And so many things that are going on right now, especially at U of M. U of M is working on an app right now and building on some technology to help. So even if a dad is not residential, he's not gone. You know, the technology exists, and they're working on that. And we want to involve that as well in the aspects of it. So, and they also have really some amazing ad campaigns. And I want to show you one real quick that they did. That kind of went bananas last year, like in Father's Day, rather, in July, in June. I came out, and if you didn't, people who weren't moved by that, you had to check and see if you were dead. So I thought there was, and there's a couple of friends of mine who are in that, a couple of dad bloggers who were filmed at the playground doing that, and that's a powerful message. I think that's the whole idea of how so many messages that young boys get are contrary to what that is in terms of, let's call attention to the fact that our kids call out for us and we do answer. So I thought about when we shifted gears a bit, we've talked about sponsors and all that sort of thing, but I think when I was trying to put this together, and again, I didn't have the benefit of these of this chart when I was convincing my landlord to rent to me, but this gives you an idea of the things we talk about at the summit, and the kind of the issues, and you can kind of see how they've evolved over the years. I mean, our first conference, I've highlighted a couple of them that I think bear attention here. I mean, if you can look at them all, obviously. Embrace the Long View, I didn't highlight that one, but I think that was an important one because we were new to this and people were thinking we were too late. And, of course, there is no such thing as too late. It's never too early to just jump in and see where this goes. And you should never not embark on something because you think you've missed the boat. There's always another boat. And so there were women who were on that panel who were talking about what it was like 5 years earlier when people were pitching mom bloggers to major brands and getting laughed out of the room. And now some of them were making six figures a year. So one of the things we talked about, the Show 'Em You Mean Business, was kind of an announcement, kind of an idea of like, dads are doing this too. We are a small group, but we're vociferous and we're dedicated and we love our kids and we're here to stay. We were trying to kind of establish ourselves and tell ourselves we were going to be around for a while, even though we honestly didn't know if we were. We didn't know if it was going to be a hit or not. So that was kind of us kind of telling ourselves, that was a pep talk that we had to give ourselves at that time. And also, there was a very important study that we talked about, because back then, obviously, we were still growing out of the Great Recession, and there was a lot of talk that stay-at-home dads were merely watching their kids because they didn't have a job. You know, and it was just a default setting. It was like, I'm watching the kids because I can't get work. And that was definitely part of it. But we talked a lot of research that said that was when the research was just becoming known that we were talking to stay-at-home dads. I mean, the recession had happened in 2008, so there was about 3 years of data to be harvested from this. And this is when dads were saying, no, I'm here because I want to. I mean, there were plenty of dads who were laid off. But at the same time, the percentage of them was more like, it was a lot less than people assumed. And that was a very important thing that I wanted to establish, especially to the brands who were there. The whole idea that we're in this because we want to. And if you look at Pew Research now, 75%, three-quarters of all men, given the choice, would love to stay home with their kids and do it because they want to. And that's kind of what's refreshing about the younger families we're seeing now. The younger families don't really care much about what system has been in place for decades. They just look at each other and say, who can work? Who can stay home? Can we get along with one income? Doesn't matter who. They just care. They don't care about how things have been. And so that's the really encouraging thing. The millennials that everyone's so crazy about, they're the ones who are making decisions solely on how things are done, purely on need and not on perception. To the extent they even can. I mean, we're going to talk a lot about paternity leave in a second here as well. That's a very volatile subject right now. And we'll be talking about that a lot in our conference in San Francisco. So we talked a lot about the fundamental shift, and we talked a lot about the man session as well, or the fundamental shift in this way, because it dovetails well with the idea of women wanting to lean in. This predates Lean In and Sheryl Sandberg and her old thing about how women need to be more aggressive in the workplace. I mean, there was all this talk about how women never ask for raises, and women are much more, I don't know, they're just less likely to rock the boat in a work environment. And Sheryl Sandberg said, no, raise the roof, rock the boat, show them your value, show them you mean business. And so that dovetails really well with what we're doing here. If you want to expect more women in the workplace, you want and recognize that is not a big deal. At the same time, you want to have men at home with kids and recognize that's not a big deal. And that's what's happening. You see lots of dads on playgrounds now because they want to. I've met a handful of them since I've been here. I mean, I work at home, so, and my younger son is 9, and we go to playgrounds every once in a while when he needs to burn off some kitty kilowatts. I don't go to the playground as much as I used to because I don't need to anymore because my son is in fourth grade and he has activities that way. But when I do go, there's tons of guys there. And that might just be Ann Arbor. But New York is the same way where I was, and that's a really encouraging trend. The younger dads are just it's not uncommon to see a dad with a snuggly and or bringing a kid to the playground and being a primary caregiver. And you know, there are not nearly the number of quizzical looks that I kind of got, or I felt I was getting back in 2003. And the last one there was about dad stereotypes and how important perceptions on screen were in terms of cultivating the idea of what fatherhood stood for. You know, we basically went to a time in the 40s and 50s when father knew best. So father was infallible and then went all the way to incompetent. Because, it's the nature of humor is to make fun of authority figures. And when dad was an infallible comedy authority figure, then you took pot shots at him. And those pot shots, they piled up. And then before too long, you had Peter Griffin and Homer Simpson, and you had Ray Romano, who, he was doing his best, but he was out of his element. He was totally, over his head. And those weren't quite the role models we were looking for. And so now you see a lot different stuff going on. And I think, obviously parenting is the best way to, to tell your kids about what kind of man your sons are going to be and what kind of man your daughters are going to find. But at the same time, what kids see on TV educates them a lot. And so whenever you can convince a brand to change its message, whenever you can convince the social construct to shift a bit and portray dads in a more nurturing way or in a more equal way with moms, you're seeing that now. You're seeing dads who are especially good at mothering, at parenting, and you see moms who are horrendous at it. And you see there's a lot of shows on right now about women who just can't even feed themselves, like there's a bunch of shows on NBC about women who are professionals who are childless and who just, eat pizza out of the box every night and live really, really interesting lives that you wouldn't associate with nurturing motherhood. And it's refreshing in that way, again, to bust these things open and recognize that people are people. So that was so we talked about that in 2012. Those were our breakout sessions. The following year, we had a great talk about the bars. You talk about how if you're a mom, the bar for success is set incredibly high, ridiculously high. If you're not perfect, you're terrible. And you see it in social media all the time. There are women out there who have to have the perfect Christmas tree and publish the perfect cookie recipe. And I've been crafting with the children. And there's a whole facade that women feel they have to have this perfection. And it's ridiculous. And at the same time, the bar for fatherhood is ridiculously low. If you're watching the children and nobody dies, you're a hero. Exactly. And I think that it seems counterintuitive to argue for us, we want to be held to a higher standard. We want higher expectations. We want people to take us seriously in parents and recognize we want to bring the bar for women down and the bar for men up. And the question was, can those two bars ever possibly coincide? And there were a lot of passionate people who said no. You want to hear the answers, yes, but the debate was remarkable. And that's kind of what I was really happy about, because you really don't want to go to a conference like this and have people blow smoke at you and just tell you what you want to hear and have it be an echo chamber. You want to have people there who will tell you the challenges you have ahead of you, who will tell you that people are going to think of you as a babysitter and not a dad. And brands think of you that way as well. They will, as long as 70% of those Google stories about dads involve abductions and violence and crimes, and the dad who left his daughter in the back of the car and she suffocated in Georgia, it's horrendous. The tide has to stop. And unfortunately, it's those 70% of the stories. I mean, those are the ones that get aggrandized, but stories about there's a nationwide program, Dads of Good Students, dogs, they're called. And it's all over the country. And they're bringing dads to schools and incorporating dads in their kids' schoolwork and meeting their teachers. There's programs all over the country that involve that. And does that get a lot of play? No, because horrendous stuff like that, which doesn't happen very often, but happens often enough to be terrible, that's newsworthy. And that's what passes for media nowadays. You have to talk about bad things to get eyeballs. And we want the eyeballs to go to the good stories. And that's, you know, I want to counterbalance that. But at the same time, we're going to have discussions that are going to be a challenge. There's a lot more, you know, one of my favorite expressions that we talk about in the Facebook group, we have a lot more work to do. There's always something. So there's no room for complacency here. So that discussion was really vital. I really enjoyed that one. And the other one was, in our second year, we had guys who were actually going to work for social media firms. And, you know, companies were now building social media departments. And guys were becoming heads of social media for companies. So about five of them got together and said, we want to show you how to do this. Because it took a lot of work. I mean, some of these guys, you had to convince them that there was even a reason for the job, much less that they were the right person for it, you know? And it's hard to report to someone who doesn't appreciate what you're doing, you know? You had to really educate them and say, this is why we need to do this. So, also, we had a great panel about righting a wrong, authentic blogging through a major life change. Lots of guys talking openly about depression, divorce. One man who lost his baby to SIDS and turned to writing. That's catharsis, to share that. And that's another interesting point about recognizing that men are vulnerable. Men are people. We don't rub dirt on it and walk it off anymore. We freak out when our kid spikes 105-degree fever. And they're saying, maybe it's time for a spinal tap, and your jaw hits the ground, as I did when my son was a month old, and he did that, and I was in the ER, and I was a friggin' mess, you know? So that's the whole idea of debunking the stoicism and recognizing that there is pain involved, and it's worthwhile to share that pain and have your brothers help you work through it. And you can still do that and be a masculine person, you know, be a responsible man who cuts down trees and whatever else men are supposed to do. I cut down a tree once, by the way. I thought it was amazing. I felt like I could wrestle alligators after I did that. Also, an interesting panel about fathers and faith on the upper right-hand corner. I think a lot of men find a moral compass even later in life. They base their fatherhood on their faith. And a lot of them have used faith to kind of get a second chance in life, especially if they're getting out of prison, if they're trying to re-enter their kids' lives, if they've made mistakes and it's time for them to make the effort and do what they can to engage with their kids again. And that was remarkable. And you want to build the tent as far open, as wide as you can to get all people talking about all sorts of things. So that was 2013 in Houston. Then we got to New Orleans. And these were, so the bottom right there, Welcome to the Juggle. We're talking a lot about that now. I mean, as that bar gets higher for dads, then we talk about the necessity of trying to juggle things. You see lots of stories now about men trying to build a work-life balance. You know, there's stay-at-home dads, obviously, but when you're a working dad and you're looking into paternity leave, or you're trying to, you know, live a life so you get to see your kid more than 2 hours a week, and you're also trying to do that and maintain the respect of your employer, and we'll talk about that a bit as well in terms of paternity leave and the stigma that a lot of men are living under. You know, they have many jobs offer paternity leave, and the men don't take it because they're worried about the money they'll lose, they'll worry about the status they'll lose. You know, their client base won't be back when they get back. They worry about the stigma of it. They worry about, there's a thing called mommy tract. You know, women in the workplace go through this all the time. They figure they're not on a tenure track, but it's kind of like, we're not going to see you as a long-term prospect to lead our company because you're just going to have a kid. And that's called being mommy tract. And so believe it or not, now the whole idea of being a dad and trying to get paternity leave, that means you could be daddy tracked. I went to a conference in D.C. in June around Father's Day. There was a Working Fathers Summit in at the White House, which was so cool. And we met the Secretary of Labor and the Secretary of the Treasury, Transportation, sorry. And also Daniel Murphy was there. Now, Daniel Murphy is the second baseman for the New York Mets. And he very famously, when his wife had a baby, she had the baby on opening day. And so when that happened, Daniel Murphy took his, you know, the collective bargaining agreement says you can take 3 days of paternity leave. And he took it. And he got destroyed in the press. He was like, how dare you? There's a game to be played. Really? Two games? He missed two games because there was an off day between the two. He missed two games out of 162 on a team that finished 10 games under 500, which is another story. But seriously? You know, he took the 2 days, he took the 3 days, which they had negotiated, and one New York pundit was saying, you know, if it's me, I would have told my wife to get a C-section, you know, 4 days earlier, so I could be there opening day. This is what I do, this is my job. Do your job. You're getting paid millions. Do your job. Nonsense. And so he came to D.C. and talked about that and said, you know what, I took that leave and I was proud of it, because long after they tell me I'm no good to play this, I'm not good enough to play this game anymore professionally, I'm going to be somebody's dad. I'm not missing out on this. And I was very happy to shake his hand. That was cool. But that's the kind of thing people deal with. It's ingrained, especially in older people, that it's just not done that way. And we're trying to flip that as well. We're trying to recognize that there is value in that. This is about the same time that Chris Hayes, who is the host of an MSNBC show at 8 o'clock, his child was born at about the same time. He took a week of paternity leave. And they did a remote interview of him at home holding his child, talking about the Daniel Murphy situation. And he was talking about how, like, you know, I'm not here to help my wife. I mean, I am, but the main purpose I'm here is to be with my kid, to bond with my child, you know, and we're doing this together. Obviously, my wife has got a lot more going on than I do. She has a whole biological thing she has to heal from. I get that. But paternity leave is not to, like, fetch juice. You know, paternity leave is there to bond with your kid. So that's a big talk about that. And so we're going to dig deeper into that this year and talk about paternity leave particularly, especially when it comes to people lobbying for it on the Hill. And people publishing academic papers, all that stuff. This one here, it's a marathon and a sprint. This was very important to me because I'll be 50 next year. So I'm not the oldest guy in the world, but I am old enough to know that that Patti Smith was a rock icon in the 70s. And I'm thankful that she's taking some time out of her busy schedule to book me for this. But the thing is, the idea of the modern dad is just an adoring 28-year-old with an infant and a snuggly, you know. But that's, you know, that's like, you don't end a movie when the wedding comes. You know, that's when you're married, that's when the adventure starts. Everything else is boring. Same thing with fatherhood. I mean, there are people, and so we had a bunch of guys there in their late 50s and 60s dealing with kids who'd had trouble with drug abuse, had trouble with the law, had trouble with functioning in society, people who still lived at home. Just to say that fathers are in this for the long haul. This is not just, if you look at dads, that's why I love that Dove Men Plus Care ad, because it talks about dads of every age. It's got dads tickling little toddlers, but it also has a dad sending his kid off to the prom. So we had that was a great discussion, because a lot of guys talked about, you know, they stick around, it gets better. It gets more interesting, but it gets better. You know, dad, fatherhood is so much more than just learning how to diaper and knowing what croup is, which is basically what I think I had all day. I know before I got here, I just kind of steamed myself in the shower to try and make this cough go away. It's worked pretty well, I think, so far. But this is what fatherhood training does for you. It helps you train yourself to get rid of your own croup when you have it. Now, and the last one was parenting it forward. And that was really a powerful thing because when you see a bunch of when you see a dad out with his kids, it struck me, it was interesting. It struck me that when you see a dad out with his with kids like that, it's common you'll hear someone say, "Oh, you must have had a great dad," you know, as an example. And the weird thing is, more often than not, the exact opposite is true. It's actually quite remarkable that many dads who have committed to their children in this way have either consciously or otherwise done so to compensate for the relationship they had with their own dads. So many, and that panel was chock full of people because they wanted to talk about their stories about how my dad was never around. And I'm a father to my kids because I don't want my kids to grow up the way I did. And I'm very lucky. I mean, my father was there the whole way through. He's a sweet man, and he taught me a lot. But one of my friends, I called my friend to moderate the panel. And I mentioned what the idea was, and he said, "I really want to moderate this." And it turns out he'd never told this to anybody before. He'd never blogged about it before. But inspired by the panel he was about to moderate, he wrote a post about how he met his father in prison because his father had shot somebody. And we were all blown away. But when you can elicit something like that, when you can elicit a real story and then someone wants to share it that way, and you can openly talk about what it's like to deal with something like that, and he is, you know, he's got three kids of his own, lives in Chicago, and is a great father. But it's amazing he is where he is based upon, I mean, it could have been his mom. He's a very lucky man, and that informs his fatherhood every day. And so that's the kind of those little moments that you don't even expect that just kind of buckle your knees a bit. And I love when that happens, when people talk about those things. And this was standing room only as well. So, now, when we talk about the conference, so much has been talked about the conference, and again, there is a financial component to this. You know, we're there to have brands invest in us. We're there to build relationships. We're there to have money that to sustain ourselves, so that more men can do this and more men can talk authentically about things and kind of become a bigger force for modern fatherhood that most of us know, but fewer of us read about. But the line I usually I talk about is before you want to sell a blog to a brand, you've got to find your groove as a writer. And before that, you've got to find your groove as a father and as a man. And so many people try this like, "Hey, it's a gold rush. It's money, 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 money." No, it is not. Do not put the cart before the horse. Work on yourself. Find your place in this world. And that is the kind of writing that brands are going to want to work with. Because it's, you know, people can smell integrity a mile away, and they can also smell falseness. So when you talk about this, you know, there's some good news and some bad news here, right? I mean, fathers spend an average of 5 more hours per week caring for children than 50 years ago. That's all fathers. That's stay-at-home fathers, working fathers, all that stuff. That's great. Fact is, though, you know, those are the residential fathers are on board a lot more, but there's twice as many non-residential fathers as there were 40 years ago. You know, and that's also the default setting of, you know, it's de rigueur, the dad moves out. You know, I went through that. I'm a divorced dad. I'm very happy with my, you know, my ex-wife is in my house right now with my kids. We get along well. We get along better as co-parents than we ever did as spouses, and I'm very grateful for that. But I'm reading stuff like this always puts my life in perspective a bit. It always puts me in a sense of, this could be so much worse. Because one of the things neither one of us wanted to do was rob our kids of a mom or a dad. Because every kid could really use both. So you look at this in terms of, you know, almost a quarter of American families without dads in the house. And then the 17.5 million children are currently fatherless. Blows my mind. And it's and to me, this is a national epidemic. This is a crisis. And what we want to do is we want to talk about how we can amplify that message and recognize that, you know, even if the father is too far gone out of the picture and there's no reconciliation option there, your children need a male role model. You know, they just do. And that's what's so great about our current efforts for mentorship that Dub Men Plus Care and Esquire are doing, because they really want, they had an article in their October magazine that basically listed 89 agencies throughout the country that talked about places where men can mentor. You know, and there's a stigma there too. There's like, you know, there was a big sign, a big drop quote that said, what if people are going to think, what if people think I'm a creepy old man for being a childless dad who wants to help a child? You know, and that's, you know, that wouldn't, that perception wouldn't exist without reality. We've all read stories about men who are afflicted in that way. And they're the ones who make it ridiculous for the rest of men who really, you know, who need kids as much as the kids need their dads. I mean, what's really amazing is I was watching True Detective, and there's a discussion. There's the two main characters talking, and one of them says, you know, after a certain age, a man without a family can be a really bad thing. You know, and there's lots of, when a man doesn't have a family or if he feels disassociated from society, that's when you see suicide spike up. That's when you see depression spike up. That's when you see real disaffection, you know, because I'm not sure where I'd be right now as a 50-year-old man if I didn't have my kids. They mean so much to me. I mean, I wouldn't want to see what that life would be like. But pairing up men with kids in mentorship areas, you know, there's got to be a way to make that happen, because there's so many disaffected men who don't know what to do with themselves and have nurturing to give and don't know how to give it. And there are plenty of boys out there who need help, and girls who need men in their lives. And that's what we want to try and flip, the whole idea that mentorship is important and it's possible. As we talked about before, the stigmas of paternity leave, always a big deal. Also, yeah, I think, you know, sooner or later it hits close to home. And that's actually a very specific story to me, because I had a problem very much like that late last year in the school year. And my son was in third grade. And I'm home. I mean, the way it works, I mean, my kids come home to my house every day, because I'm home. I work at home. I work anywhere there's a laptop and a phone. And I'm very grateful for that opportunity too. So I work at home a lot. And so that way, when my kids get out of school, 4 o'clock, I'm home. And they come to me. And so during this time, my son brought a friend home. He lived around the corner. And they were best pals. They used to come home together almost every day. He'd come in and help himself to the fridge. You know, hey, Mr. French, how you doing? And then just go and grab, you know, eat every cracker I had in the house and, you know, drink 4 gallons of milk and play Wii for a bit and then, you know, toddle off home. Thank you, you know. And he was a good kid, you know, and they got along really well, my son and he. And then things took a turn. You know, all of a sudden, you know, my son would run home and he'd run home and close the door breathless and say, you know, he's right behind me. Don't let him come in. And he would run to his bedroom and shut the door. And I'm like, what's going on here? This guy's been hanging out in our house for months. What's going on? And it turns out he was harassing him. He was kind of like, you know, kind of bumping him in on the sidewalk. They would walk home together. And he would kind of just bump him and say stuff to him and stuff. And he just wanted to avoid him at all costs. Basically, every walk home was choreographed to when this other kid got out of school so we could hopefully get out before he got out, or, you know, not interact with him. And as you could expect, you know, it one day it escalated. There was a whole Donnybrook, and punches were thrown, and there was a huge fight. And so that meant a conference with the principal and my son and the kid and his mom and my ex and me. So we're in that meeting, and their teacher, they're in the same class, and we're in that meeting, and in that meeting, his mom mentioned that about a month ago, that kid's dad had just called him from California and said, "I live here now." You know, didn't even you know, break it to him and kind of say, "I'm going to move to California next week or next month, and this is why. I love you. Don't worry, I'm moving away, but I'll always be in your life." You know, all the things I would expect I would have to say if I ever even dreamed the idea of moving across the country from my kids, which I still haven't. But yeah, he just basically called and said, "I've moved to California with my girlfriend." And the shock of that, he was still processing that. And so when he looked at that anger, he centered a lot of that anger on my son, not least because he knew my son came home to his dad every day. And the kid just bawled his eyes out when it happened. And he hadn't had a chance to do that. He hadn't grieved. So, and it was remarkable. I mean, it's like you talk about an incident that happens, given the, you know, the stuff I try to work on, the stuff I do for a living. It was like, wow, this is right in my life. So I'm very happy that that seems to be resolved now. But, you know, all I could think about is, what is this guy thinking? And so much of that thinking is prevalent. It's just, come on, guys. You know, get in there. Be in the arena. Be a dad. And so I want everyone to know how important dads are, and I want how important dads are to their kids, how important kids are to their dads, and recognize that, you know, when I give talks like this, there's always somebody who talks about their own relationship with their own father or the father of their kids or their own children. Something terrible has happened with the dad. And again, we're trying to roll that back a bit. We're trying to say, you know what, there's lots of dads out there who will move heaven and earth and will take a bullet for their children, because that's what men are supposed to do. It's when you father somebody, you're in for the long haul. And just because the biological link is not there, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's not value in a father's perspective on how to raise people, you know. In fact, there was a discussion about this. You may recall there was a, on Time Magazine, I did not put it up here because it's provocative. It's a provocative cover, but the cover of Time Magazine had a picture of a woman breastfeeding her three-year-old. And she was standing there with her shirt down like this, and the two-year-old was like standing on a step stool with his mouth on her breast, you know, looking at the camera. And the headline was, "Are you mom enough?" I mean, you talk about the most naked link bait. Let's provoke some people. Let's get some people ticked off, you know? And it went. It had the effect everyone hoped. It was just a firestorm. Never mind, of course, that the article itself was perfectly reasoned. It was a discussion about how the bar for womanhood is way too high, and we need to bring it down a bit. But the editors said, "We got to make, you know, that's boring. So we got to dress it up, and we got to put this picture on it, and we got to put this headline on it." Never mind that a friend of mine who used to write for Time, he wrote a piece in that same article about fatherhood and how there is value in fatherhood. People talk about how, you know, a mother can bond with the child in only the only way a mother can, because she bore him. You know, there's just that connection that you can't possibly sever. And that's true. At the same time, though, there's value in not having borne the child for 9 months. There's actually a different perspective from being someone who loves the child but can come at this from someone, you know, this was a much more radical thing to say. But that was, you know, it was because of the whole idea of, like, let's use, you know, if let's use the attachment parenting thing that's going on. let's call for, you know, it was a call for detachment parenting, basically, because in so many cases, attachment parenting becomes helicopter parenting. And there are times when a father's perspective can be a tonic and can counterbalance, you know, how the moms feel. And again, it's not meant to be mine is better, but it's meant to be mine is valid. It's a discussion point. Yes?
I think maybe I'm missing the point, but I think I'm not really engaged in what you're talking about very much, but I think breastfeeding a child is one of the best things that ever happened to a kid.
Oh, no, we're not saying you shouldn't breastfeed the kid. I mean, the point was putting the breastfeeding on the cover of a magazine. And kind of because there are laws, there are some people who think breastfeeding shouldn't be in public. There are lots of areas of the country where breastfeeding is outlawed, and people say it's indecent, and that's ridiculous. I agree. My kid's mom breastfed both of them, and it is the best thing they can do. And the point was just the provocative aspect of the way, and of course they chose a woman who was 28 years old and a size 2. You know, just kind of. You know, like that, like because if you're going to put a topless woman on a magazine cover, she's got to have a, you know, look a certain way. But no. I am breastfeeding is we're a big fan of that. You know, I'm still very good friends with my ex mother-in-law, and she's a La Leche League from way back when. So you know, I'm in the boat on that.
Okay.
But I'm glad we clarified that. So. A few more facts about boys particularly. I mean, I talk about boys a lot because I have boys of my own, and I've read a lot of, I spend lots of time reading books about the trouble with boys. Peg Tyer started it off with her book about 6-7 years ago. It's just the way that education is currently, there is a male hegemony in this world. You know, I mean, men govern everything and own everything, but whatever hegemony we have is rotting from the inside. Because when you talk about the way we're educating our boys,
at every level,
even university, from preschool to grad level. I mean, if you look at this, so and again, some facts there, right? ADHD, 15.1% is more than twice the rate for girls. Expelled 5 times as often as girls. 3 times the rate of D's and F's. Double the score below basic levels in reading and writing. And juvenile arrest rate is more than twice for girls. 71% of juvenile offenders are boys. And so we talk about this in terms of how... and I made a point of this as well. I actually wrote a blog post last year, or 2 years ago now. My older son graduated elementary school, and at the graduation ceremony, which you need for a fifth grader, they asked 6 students from the class to write essays about their experience at the school and about, isn't it great to be here at the school, and we are looking forward to the challenge of middle school and yada, yada. And I wrote a post because it just turned out all 6 of them were girls. You know, and I used to be a math teacher, so I'm saying, you know, the odds of picking 6 girls at random is 1/2 to the 6th power. You know, that's less than 1.001% of a chance of picking them all at random. So I was like, why were they all girls? And it sparked off, it went viral. It was a big discussion about that. It's like, well, boys will come around in middle school and high school when the athleticism comes in, and they become the stars and the jocks. And I was like, well, but the facts just don't bear that out. Because everywhere you look, girls are outperforming boys in school everywhere. And that's what worries me. It's getting to the point now where applying to college is like an affirmative action thing for boys. It's actually better to be a boy because you get so many more girls' applications. And I think we talk about how, you know, we can spend a lot of time talking about the scourge of rudderless adolescence. I mean, the University of Michigan does a lot of work with that in terms of it's a vicious cycle, in terms of that's how you get gang activity. That's how I mean, there is energy that boys have that is not being harnessed. It's not being addressed. It's not being understood. And there are some kind of there are some schools that are trying to create boy-based curricula. I mean, my son goes to an all-boys school now, which I think is working really well for him. I'm really glad he goes there. And I think, you know, even something like a standing desk, you know, or anything to kind of...
They do wheels now for their feet because it helps
brain. There you go, yeah. They have wheels for the feet. There are just things that help monitor, you know, there's got to be more to life than just signing somebody off as ADHD and then, you know, drugging him up and then hope for the best. And I think, and that's, so much of that is, it's so very short-sighted, you know, for the same reason that, you know, we're investing more in prisons than we are in trying to make, turn boys into better men, because there's profit in prisons. And, you know, and so you look at prisons and how, you know, I think it's 10 times, the ratio of prisoners is 10 to 1 men, and we have the highest per capita prison population in the world. So it all seems very short-sighted, and I don't want my kids to grow up in a time, I don't want masculinity to stand for that. I want my kids to grow up in a more enlightened sense of that. So a few more facts here. Threatened with a weapon. Suicide is remarkable how the percentages go, those age groups that go twice as likely, four times as likely, five times as likely. It's very easy to feel disaffected and feel like you're not measuring up to some metric that doesn't exist. And kids don't know any different. As we talked about before, 56.5% of all undergrad enrollments and nearly 60% of bachelor's and master's degrees. And that's been trending upward for, you know, for forever. I mean, when my kids are old enough to apply to college, it'll be closer to 65. So this is what dads think about. So this is the money shot right here, guys. This is the end quote from my friend Stephen March. He is a writer in Toronto. And many of the facts that I quoted for you are quoted from that article. And if you want to look at Manifesto of the New Fatherhood in Esquire, it's online. If you Google that, you will find it. And if you look at that article, you will see the sources from which all these facts came. But fathers spending time with their children results in a better, healthier, more educated, more stable, less criminal world. Exposure to fathers is a public good. That resonated like gangbusters to me, because to have this many kids without fathers is a national tragedy. And to have, especially when there is so much more energy that could be put in positive directions for this, and how much better off we could all be. I don't know how much fruit our efforts are going to have, but I think that the more we get involved with social media for social good is a part of that. If you look at, I went to the One conference, which talks about trying to save the girls who were kidnapped in Africa by Boko Haram. And we had a big conference in Washington in September. There was a He for She. That's part of the world, the United Nations. Emma Watson was part of that, and they asked a bunch of men. And they asked me to write a story about how women being just being beaten down in our culture. I mean, it's what goes on outside the U.S. is just horrendous, and we've all read about that. And so we talk about, you know, the kidnappings, the beatings, the sterilizations, the circumcisions, the foot binding. And every year we also have a big push for Movember. Does anyone know what Movember is? That's when you grow a mustache. And someone sponsors your mustache, and the money goes to research into pancreatic and prostate and testicular cancer. So men's cancers, men's depression, men's health goes to Live Strong, the Lance Armstrong Foundation. I'm not sure if it's called that anymore since Lance Armstrong kind of fell out of favor, but it's still the organization is still going strong. And so that is my mustache from last month. I mean, the whole point is rather than wear an awareness ribbon, men can actually grow one on their faces. So that's my mustache. And when I walked into the door on Thanksgiving, my sister said, "You look just like our English teacher." And that should tell you how bearably true that was.
Who's the guy on the left?
That's my high school English teacher.
Oh, and you're the guy on the right?
I'm the guy on the right with a mustache. And I walked in for Thanksgiving, and my sister said, "Oh, my God, you look just like Mr. Allen." And Mr. Allen was famous for being one of the duller people on the planet. No offense, Mr. Allen, if you're out there, but everyone has Mr. Allen stories, and now I karma is a bitch. So that is November is we had a big campaign. We had a dads got together and raised about $15,000. And we've had corporate sponsors in the past. Microsoft gave us some money. Dove Men Plus Care gave us some money this year. So the social media for social good aspect is a real help for that,
I
think.
Are you saying that he was not a very exciting or interesting person?
His lectures were, and again, I don't want to spend too much time denigrating the man because he did teach me a lot about Ethan Frome, and he taught me a lot about Romeo and Juliet, a lot about Shakespeare. So it wasn't the most dynamic personality, but, you know, I mean, who am I to judge? Because the fact is, it was also the perspective of a 16-year-old, and what do I know? I mean, he could have been a lot more interesting now if I knew him as an adult than if I knew him. That's the lens I'm filtering him through. Dad resources. The National At-Home Dad Network is huge. It's all over the country. Life of Dad is a social networking site that does lots of podcasts with famous men who give talk about what it's like to be a dad. And of course, Facebook and Twitter, there's all kinds of Facebook groups. I mean, I brought that here in case there were new dads. Because one of the things I really want to do is talk about also their City Dads group. They started in New York and grew to over 1,000 dads. And now they've expanded to 15 sites. This is actually an old picture. You want to add, there's one in Portland as well. And so these are groups. These are dads who get together. They have play dates with their kids. They have days out without their kids. But it's community. It's getting dads together to talk about fatherhood, to talk about what it's like to be in their situation and work out the challenges. I mean, being a parent is hard. And one of the things I also want to call attention to is there is nothing in the mitten. So there is a concerted effort to get people together for either, I don't know what shape it'll take, and if it'll be Ann Arbor, Flint, Detroit, the southeastern Michigan triangle, whatever. But that is something I'd like to help establish if anyone's interested in that. There is a social media component to it. There is one in Columbus, so anybody who's an Ohio State fan can maybe see that as a challenge. But anyway, to conclude, we're going to be in San Francisco February 19th and the 21st. It's our fourth conference. We're very excited to go to San Francisco. It's our most cosmopolitan site yet. It's very international, very diverse, and we're going to get people from Australia this time because it's easy to get to. You know, we've chosen a West Coast site for a change. For the longest time, we've been in South Central U.S. because we wanted people to be able to get there easily and be warm because we're in February. But this year, we're like, you know what? We need to go someplace where the action is. And so we're going to San Francisco. And we're very excited about that. And you can read about us. I mean, there's a Facebook page. There's our Twitter feed and dadtosummit.com as well in terms of what we're trying to do. But I really appreciate you guys coming out tonight. And if you have any questions, I'm here. Otherwise, thank you all very much.